Dr. Paul, welcome to With the Wind, Science Revealed. My guest today is Richard Moskowitz, family practitioner for 50 years. We discuss natural versus vaccine-induced immunity, the importance of getting childhood infections, and then he shares deeply from his heart with Dee Dee profound insights about not having his own family follow his approach and on what the word truth means. Enjoy the show. Dr. Paul, coming to you from the heart. We're going to touch on the unknown and what to do about it. You know, in the fall, we've typically been worried about flu. It's a seasonal thing. Now it's not just flu, it's COVID, RSV, and the flu. Nothing has happened yet, and yet you've sensed this anxiety and tension around it all. So I would encourage you to think about this. Make a decision now, before anything happens, about what you're going to do. So if they mandate masks, I'm not going to wear them. If there are mandates for vaccines, I won't comply. If we have a total lockdown in the state I'm living in, I'll leave the state. I think if we make those decisions ahead of time, there'll be a lot less fear, and you can move through whatever's coming with a sense of confidence and peace. Welcome, Richard Moskowitz, to With the Wind, Science Revealed. It's such a privilege to have you on the show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you, Paul.
I wished I had known you probably about 45 years ago. You were on top of a lot of the information I've had to sort out over the last couple decades, and you've been on top of this, so I'm really looking forward to talking to you.
Right.
You have been doing family practice for 50 years, actually since I was 10 years old. You were working in the homeopathy area for, I think, about 45 of those years. Mm-hmm. You've written 5 books, a couple of them on homeopathy in 1992 and 2001. I've just finished going through your vaccines, a reappraisal that you published in 2017. That book is so timely for folks who happen to be listening and haven't heard of that book. It's that one right there. It's so well done. So thank you for that.
Thanks.
And you've written so many articles, homeopathy, vaccines, chronic disease. As we get started, I like to get to know you a little better. Can you talk about your journey, maybe if you want, as far as right back from childhood through medical school, and what got you to go towards homeopathy?
Boy, that's a good story. Yeah, I never felt right in medical school. It just didn't. I had ethical problems, but I also had scientific problems, and they were all mixed up together. And it really wasn't until later, until I started practicing. It was during the Vietnam era, and I realized that the imagery of medicine is military. That it's antibiotics and antihypertensives and the war against cancer. And it was military. And I was active in the anti-war movement, and it put it to me in a clearer way.
That makes sense. I think back to our residency training, and there's this hierarchy, just like in the military. The medical student looks up to the intern, who looks up to the resident, who looks up to the attending. And right. If the orders come from above, we follow, right?
Exactly. And there were orders that I couldn't follow, but I was too timid to protest them. I just would absent myself. When I was a junior in college, I got a traineeship in biochemistry at a cancer research lab in Maine. And it was very routine, injecting some mice with various chemicals and checking the electrophoretic patterns of their serum proteins, which was a new method at that time. And then you would sacrifice the animals at the end of it, which was maybe 3 or 4 a week. And it horrified me. I just felt the routineness of it, really. I felt like I was being trained to be Dr. Mengele, and this place was an Auschwitz for mice.
Yeah, the mice are not treated well in medicine, that's for sure.
So I would just go to the library and hide out there. I just didn't want to do it.
Yeah. Was there something in your childhood that sort of prepared you to be aware of these things, or maybe to be different than the standard medical student?
It's interesting because I've thought about that a lot. And what I always come up with is my grandfather's death at the age of 5 or 6. And I remember when I saw him in his last days, and he looked really sick, and that night I realized that he was going to die and that I was going to die. And it was certain. It was a standard of truth that was utterly unprecedented for me. So it just crystallized for me something that was completely unacceptable and yet completely certain. And I'm sure that had a lot to do with why I became a physician, because I'm basically academically inclined. I'm very studious, and a profession like history or philosophy would have probably suited me better. But somehow I needed to deal with this in some way. And at the same time, it was so frightening to me that I'm sure it also had to do with my reluctance to study it at the same time.
But doctors are all about preventing death. So how did that set you apart from others?
Say that again. What?
Doctors in general, we were all taught and we were all about, we're going to keep people alive no matter what. So it's about preventing death. But you went a different route, it seems.
Yeah. That's what was a powerful teaching experience for me, a learning experience. It was one of the formative experiences of my life, I'm sure. And it continued. Like when I was in high school and I tried out for the football team, and they had us running up and down the field doing wind sprints, and I was getting really winded. So I went to the doctor by myself for the first time. I was like 15. And he percussed my chest and he listened to my lungs and he sat there very thoughtfully. And finally he said, "Sonny boy, we can't all be Jackie Robinson." Crushed though I was, it liberated me from feeling that I had to live up to the impossible standards that I had subconsciously set myself. Because my brother and my father were both very athletic. And so I was able to play for 2 seasons, and I enjoyed the rough and tumble of the game, and I didn't get hurt too bad, and it was fine. But then at the same time, I got a job as an orderly in the local hospital, and I was cleaning up all the stuff. And
we share that experience.
And I just had the sense that the needs of patients were overwhelming, and inexhaustible. No matter how much care and love we bestowed on them, it was not going to be enough.
Yeah.
And so again, the same ambivalence was there. I loved the way this doctor was with me. He inspired me. So that ambivalence was basic to my evolution. And
interesting. So you've had this ambivalence that goes throughout your childhood. Oh, yeah. And then it plays out during and after residency. You're now practicing as a family practitioner. Were you in solo practice?
Yes.
So one of the true pioneers of what you call the old traditional family doc.
Exactly.
You were delivering babies at home and taking care of the whole family.
Yeah, I was out in Colorado when I started. I got my fellowship in philosophy. Before I interned and went into practice, I took a fellowship in philosophy. I just had to get into something academic that I could think about, and without even consciously thinking about what I'd just been through. But somehow, it was an asylum that I needed, and that was the time of the hippies and the counterculture, and these 14-year-old kids were running away from home and smoking dope and dropping acid and having sex, and it was all right there in Boulder.
Since you preceded my entering into the world of medicine by at least 15 years, I'd really be curious. Let's pivot to the topic of childhood vaccines. because that's such an important topic for our listeners today.
Oh, yeah.
That whole schedule has exploded. What was it like when you started practice with regards to vaccines? What was going on at that point?
Before I answer that question, I just want to say that it was always an important subject for me. And in the beginning, it was just a gut feeling. I just didn't like the idea of doing it. I didn't know why exactly, other than a lot of the diseases were not that serious. And just requiring people to do it and not being allowed to go to school if they didn't. And it just seemed way out of proportion.
Yeah. And were those mandates in place when you started practice?
There were a few, but they weren't enforced that strictly, especially in Massachusetts. By the time I moved there, that was in 82, it was there were a few mandates, but the courts had decided in Massachusetts that in order to claim a religious exemption, it was just a personal belief. You didn't have to belong to some kooky church or anything.
And yeah, I was in med school at that point, and I think all we had was the DPT, the polio, and the MMR.
Yeah, the MMR was already, that came in the 60s, I think.
Yeah. So when you started practice, were you doing some vaccines?
No.
Did you ever do vaccines?
Never.
So did you use homeopathy, like homeoprophylaxis, or?
No, I didn't.
Then what was your experience? Here's, folks, we got a doctor I'm talking to who had 50 years of practice with families, children included. What was your experience with the diseases for which there were vaccines? In other words, presumably you would have lost a bunch of patients to measles, mumps, rubella, and whooping cough and all those things.
No.
You didn't?
I didn't.
Not one?
Most of those were diseases of children that were ordinary that I had myself. I remember vividly having the measles when I was 7 or 8 or whatever it was, staying home from school for a week and my mother waiting on me hand and foot. Those were the days when the mother stayed home. And there were 2-paycheck families back then so much. And so I had a grand old time. And then later I began to study and I found that coming down with and recovering from an acute disease like the measles actually protected from developing cancer and autoimmune diseases later in the future.
Yeah.
But that was quite a bit later. In the beginning, like I said, it was just a gut feeling. And then by the time I went to Boston, I decided that I was going to take a year off and just study. And so I got into immunology a little bit, stuff I should have learned in med school, but it really wasn't emphasized at all. And so it impressed me that the basis of coming down with and recovering from an acute illness like the measles, that's an acute phenomenon. It's like the whole immune system is mobilized and there are all these separate mechanisms that are concerted and going on simultaneously with coordination. And the result of all of that, all of the cytokines and the macrophages and all of that was to expel the foreign organism from the body. And whereas with the vaccine, it's the opposite. It's like it has to stay in there in order to keep making those antibodies because you can't achieve real immunity using one mechanism separate from all those others. Vaccination is a chronic phenomenon by definition.
And your book made that really clear in a very nice way. And if I can restate.
But that was just like intellectual. It's still, here I was in practice, and it didn't really hit me until I started seeing the patients with that in mind. And what I found was that there were so many vaccines so close together that it was very difficult to tell. First of all, it was very hard to tell what any specific vaccine was doing. First of all, and that's what we were trained to do, is to look for this vaccine and that vaccine, not the vaccination process per se. We don't even think about that. So that was one thing. And in the beginning, what I saw were things that could be related to a specific vaccine because the symptoms were vaguely similar to the disease that it was supposed to be preventing. But a lot of the vaccines were triple to begin with. And there were so many being given so often that it was impossible to tell for sure that it was because of the vaccine, because the disease was coming and going anyway. But what I started to notice by the late 80s, I think it was, the kids were reacting nonspecifically. They were reacting, they were more prone to develop whatever acute diseases were going around the neighborhood, or most of all, it was making worse the chronic illnesses that they already had.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you to go back a little bit in your career there at the beginning and the leading up to the mid 1980s, let's say. I don't recall, I was just a kid and then I was in training. I don't recall chronic disease being very prevalent. I never saw a case of autism growing up. I didn't see a case in medical school. I saw a couple mild cases of PDD when I was in pediatric residency. And there just were very few chronically ill kids. Did you have that same experience?
Yes and no. I'm going back now to my internship, to my medical school. And what was truly shocking to me about medical school was that I grew up thinking about disease as an acute phenomenon, that it was something you came down with, you got over it, or you didn't, or you died. But somehow in Bellevue Hospital in New York, disease was the overwhelming something. It was there in the atmosphere of the ward. I could almost smell it when the beds were empty. So I had dystopian fantasies about that. But you're right, on a clinical level, I didn't see a lot of chronic diseases. It's just that
I'm talking about kids. Since you were family practice, you were also seeing adults. And I remember rotating in the VA hospital and everybody smokes and drinks and they've got all the problems related to that. But for kids, do you remember seeing a lot of chronic disease?
No, you're right. No. And even when I got to Boston, the main one that I was seeing was ear infections, chronic ear infections.
Correct.
That was like ubiquitous.
While you're on that, I got to ask you, how about in your personal practice, since you were not vaccinating, in your unvaccinated children, were they getting all these chronic ear infections?
Somewhat, but not nearly to the same extent. But that took a while to see. I just had to accumulate a big number of cases. And the whole thing evolves very slowly.
True.
But it was just fortifying me in this feeling like, just don't do this, that this is a source of chronic disease. Mm-hmm. And the perfect example, if you read the book, you'd probably remember this, but it's the purest example of making worse what's already there. I had a kid that I had seen as a child in elementary school. She had OCD really bad. She was wetting the bed. And I gave her a bunch of remedies. And finally, I hit on one. I think it was arsenic amalgam. And it just went away. And she was great. She was essentially symptom free for over 10 years. And then it was time for her to go to college. They required an MMR booster. And within a week, the whole thing came back just like it used to be. It was like I knew immediately there was no question in the mother's mind or in my mind what was happening. And fortunately, the same medicine was extremely effective once again. And she finished college, no problem. And she went on and got married and had kids of her own. She was fine. But I saw this over and over again.
Yeah. You mentioned it beautifully in the book that you would see these kids who had chronic conditions who had been vaccinated in some other practice.
Right.
Come to see you for homeopathy management, I imagine.
Right.
And you eventually are able to find the right remedy and help them recover. Somehow they get another vaccine or a series of vaccines and they go right back into their chronic problems.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It's, and that is so powerful, that statement that you just made. In my case, it was, I didn't have the homeopathy remedies because that's not in my wheelhouse to recover kids necessarily. I would help kids recover in different ways. And generally, they would not ever go back to getting vaccines again. But I imagine if they had, similar experience would have happened.
The other thing that made it invisible was that in order to show it really clearly, the kid had to be essentially be symptom-free for a period of time. And then when they get the booster, it's back. And so the parents see it, and even the pediatrician sees it, if he's still involved in the case.
Right.
Whereas giving them antibiotics and suppressive drugs doesn't do that. If you gave them herbs, perhaps, or acupuncture or some other thing, it might well do the same thing. But ordinarily, you're still going to get the ebbs and flows of the chronic illness that conceals it. It makes it somewhat invisible.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that it would be a simple matter to investigate this claim by simply, let me just say this, that the diseases involved ran the whole gamut of pediatrics, of normal pediatrics, that, you know, the autoimmune diseases and the neuro diseases and the ADHD and the autism and everything. It was all in the soup. And it didn't matter which vaccine it was. It didn't matter what disease it was or how severely the kid suffered from it. The same exact pattern was true.
And so that pattern being they could recover with homeopathy, and then if they got vaccinated again, they regressed right back to their chronic condition.
Yeah, I call it making worse what's already there.
Yeah.
Except what that omits is the times when it actually initiates the disease, when it first makes it manifest, where before it had only been latent, perhaps.
Yeah. Imagine you heard your fair share of stories of kids who were doing fine, got a vaccine or a series of vaccines, regressed into autism.
Sure.
And what percentage of those kids were you able to help recover?
I didn't actually have occasion to treat that many of them, but pretty good. I'd say I did well, although, like, I published a case of an autistic kid that I treated very successfully, but he was still autistic. He was still handicapped. He was growing up, he was a neat kid. He had a job. He was, by the time I stopped seeing him, he was in his 20s, but he still was going to need help. He wasn't cured by any stretch, but he was capable of living a life.
Yeah.
And I would say that would be what I would expect.
Yeah, there's a whole range of recovery I've experienced from almost complete to always. Often they get stuck at the ADD, ADHD when you're recovering a child who is severely autistic.
Yep.
I want to go back to something that I think is perhaps the most important thing you've shared both in your book and alluded to in the beginning of our interview, and that is natural immunity versus the vaccine-induced immunity. I think for our people to understand the difference and how so important it is to actually stay on the natural immunity side of things, don't distort the immunity with vaccines. You write about that, and it's complicated when we get into our medical thinking about it, the cytokines and all that stuff. Right, it can become a little overwhelming. But in just layman's terms, how could you try describing that for our listeners?
Sure. There are a number of mechanisms that come into play when a foreign organism develop an infection from an acute infection, usually with fever. So the first thing you do, the mucous membranes of the portal of entry, the place where it comes in, are sensitized. And that's so that you can then expel them through the same route by sneezing or coughing, the same way you acquired it in the first place. Then you have macrophages who are that are wandering around the blood and pick up foreign organisms and try to digest them. And you have cytokines, you have these specialized proteins that will signal the macrophages to go where they're supposed to go, where the monocytes, as the case may be.
And I use the term Pac-Man-like for macrophages for people to illustrate, just gobbling up whatever infection needs to be gobbled up.
Exactly.
And that process is getting the disease out before it ever gets a deep foothold in the body.
And then you have the serum complement, these proteins that assist that process that I forget actually what they do exactly, but they somehow help to clump them and make it easier for the macrophages to do their work. And then you have the cytokines, as I said, the signals. And then finally, you begin to develop antibodies. And I remember in the case of the measles, the antibodies start to appear at the same time that the symptoms are appearing. And the antibodies are, again, assisting the process. So it's all coordinated together. You can't achieve the expulsion of the virus or the bacterium, whatever it happens to be, by any one of those mechanisms by itself. It's a coordinated process. That's the main thing.
Right. That first phase where you've got the cellular activity going on with macrophages and all that, I think we can refer to that more as innate immunity or natural immunity.
Cellular immunity.
Yeah.
And that's what governs, that's what regulates the whole part. The antibodies are special in the sense that they're called the humoral aspect and they depend on that.
Yeah. They're what give you memory later on to some extent. There actually is memory at the cellular level now too. That's been published.
Right.
But our prior understanding was you needed the antibodies to have memory so you could fight the infection in the future. And the whole vaccine industry, correct me if I'm wrong, just focused on antibodies.
Yes.
And so they're focusing on this last phase of preventing infection.
Yes.
And the infection has to get into the body and take over, and then you get antibodies. So when you do antibodies artificially with vaccines, I think that's the problem, right? You haven't provided the way to keep the infection out of the body.
Yeah, you haven't expelled it. You are quite the opposite. You've driven it deeper into the internal organs of the immune system. And it must be there because if it weren't there, it doesn't get encrypted into the cells unless you expel it. So it has to stay there.
Yeah.
And
can you explain for folks, because I know, let's just take measles as an example, because people are always so afraid of measles. And like you, I had measles as a child and I was in Africa. Yeah, it was not fun, but it wasn't horrible. And all my siblings and our friends got measles. We have lasting immunity. I know if you were born 1957, which was my birth year, or before, you don't ever have to go get a measles vaccine. They know that we're naturally protected. Compare that to what kind of protection you get from the vaccine and where do we go from here, given the fact that we have a whole two generations of folks who are vaccinated as far as their immunity.
Yeah, I call it counterfeit immunity or fake immunity. It's the shadow, but it lacks the substance. And above all, it lacks this immunity is both specific and non-specific. That is, you have the specific immunity against the disease that you've already had, but you also have the priming of the immune mechanism as a whole to deal with whatever infections are going to come about in the future. And in some way that really needs to be investigated, I think, that is what's protective. That's what makes it less likely that you're going to develop autoimmune diseases and cancer later in life. And that's what we need to understand. And it's ironic that I think vaccines are the way for us to understand it.
Yeah.
Because we know, or we should know, or we will know. That's one of the main ways that chronic diseases occur. And we know how vaccines work because we have to study that in order to make them do whatever it is that they do. So it could be a valuable tool for us.
Yeah. So if I understood what you were saying correctly, you and I who had measles naturally, we got specific immunity for against measles, but we also got this non-specific protection that helps us not only prevent other chronic diseases, but probably if the measles virus was to mutate or change, we would recognize it because of the non-specific immunity that we got. I think for COVID, let's pivot to that. And I'm just interested in your thoughts about that. Kids did well. Unvaccinated kids, I had a practice with, I don't know, close to 10,000 patients during the early parts of COVID. And not one kid ended up in the hospital. Their parents might get a little bit sick. Kids did fine. I'm guessing that's that same thing. They've seen coronaviruses in the past. And so they have that non-specific recognition of that family of viruses and they just get rid of it. But what are your thoughts about COVID? What's happened? Where we're headed?
Yeah, COVID, that's a whole other level of this same problem. But Naomi Klein calls it disaster capitalism. I think she would disown my applying it to this phenomenon, but that's all right. She doesn't own it exclusively anymore. It's public now. But yeah, you have a disaster as the opportunity for various marketable reforms to take place that otherwise would not take place. I think it started even before the COVID when the drug companies made their big offensive to eliminate the exemptions to the vaccines back in 2015, 16, 17, 18. There were a few measles outbreaks, and they were trying to eliminate the personal belief in philosophical and religious exemptions and succeeded in California, for example.
Yeah, California, New York, and Maine were added to the list of Mississippi and West Virginia.
Yeah, it's ironic that was true in Mississippi because that's one of the reddest states, and it illustrates the about face that has taken place.
Would your recommendation be for parents? They just added the COVID jab to the childhood immunization schedule starting at 6 months, as you probably are aware. What would you tell parents if they go into their pediatrician and their pediatrician says, well, there's a new variant coming out and these vaccines they're safe and effective, they've improved them? What would you tell those parents?
In a word, I would say don't do it. But I would go on to say that the vaccines are special. This is really the first time that a vaccine has been given in the midst of an outbreak rather than to prevent it in the indefinite future. So that really, and it's since been found out, I'm sure it was known even before this, but it's been publicly admitted that it doesn't prevent transmission. So the only effect of the new mRNA vaccines is simply to treat the illness, essentially, to lessen its severity, to relieve the symptoms. So it's a rival of the already existing drugs that do have such an effect, but have been banned because of that reason, because they are competing with this new product. So you have a lot of cynicism here because it was clear that I'm sure that they must have known that right at the beginning, but they didn't say so. They implied that it would prevent the disease to begin with.
And of course, it hasn't. You started off by saying they rolled this out during an active pandemic, and you were alluding to the fact that was a big mistake. Why is that? Yeah. Why is it a big mistake?
First of all, there are two main reasons. The first is that they made a lockdown of the society. They locked people in their homes. They couldn't go to work. Their businesses began to fail. It became a catastrophic phenomenon for the whole country, such that leading epidemiologists right from the beginning said, don't do this. This is a big mistake.
And in retrospect, it sure seemed unnecessary, that's for sure. They were saying you got to keep kids out of school and keep them on masked up and isolated so you can protect grandma. And based on all the conversation we've had prior to this point, had we let the kids all go to school, they would have developed even more robust natural immunity. Yeah, and exactly. Therefore, they would have protected grandma. They would have been that shield.
And therefore, we wouldn't have needed the vaccine. And it sounds like a conspiracy theory to say it, but it's obviously the case that if that had been true, the outbreak would have been finished by the summer of 2020.
Yeah.
And Luc Montagnier said it very clearly that by vaccinating in the midst of the epidemic, you're prolonging the outbreak and you're making room for lots of variants to appear.
And that's already what happened, right? So many
variants.
They were already
appearing. The virus was already notorious for its mutability, but this made it even worse.
Yeah. So when they make the same recommendations, it looks like they're coming soon. But you've got to get this new COVID jab. They've now addressed new variants, blah, blah, blah. It's just the same problem, right? We're still in the middle of an ongoing endemic, if you will. It's not even a pandemic. This thing is here to stay.
Yeah. And I think it's their last ditch thing, as if they understand that this whole thing is going to blow up in their face one of these days. Unfortunately, a lot of people are going to die or be crippled before we figure it out.
But, crippled by the disease or by the vaccine or the shot, rather?
By everything. By being poor at a time of a lockdown, by all sorts of things. We had the most eminent epidemiologists were saying this right from the beginning in 2020. Knut Witkowski, for example, at the Rockefeller Institute, and he just said it straight out. He said, let the kids get it. Their risk is practically zero. This is the way we've always dealt with these things.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even epidemiologists who are pro-vaccine thought it was a big mistake. I'm trying to think of who.
No, I completely agree with you. As we wrap up, and then Dee Dee's going to come get personal with you, dig into who you are as a man, or if you're a father or a grandfather, those sort of things. What would you like to leave as take-home message to our viewers? Take your vast 50 years of private family practice, the world as it is today. What do you want people to know and understand?
Mainly that I think we need to look at healing in a different way from simply forcing the body to behave in whatever targeted ways we think it should. But rather than forcing the body to behave, I think we need to find ways to stimulate or encourage it to behave and have some appreciation for the natural process that's already there, rather than trying to see the illness purely as an enemy.
I like that. What would be the top ways that a person can facilitate, promote, encourage the natural healing process?
First of all, by removing things that are obviously going to poison that. And that's, I think, the big topic for us today is chronic disease. That's where we're at. It's exploding. And we need to investigate that. And it would be a relatively simple matter to do it. All we would have to do would be to measure the all-cause mortality and morbidity of vaccinated versus unvaccinated, for example, and do that in an independent way that wasn't simply paid for by the drug companies. And then we would learn something, and then we could use what we know about the vaccines to teach us how this process gets underway. But anyway, that's more specific than your question. So yeah, just appreciate the healing power of nature, of the body as it's evolved over these millennia, that most acute diseases with fever are benign and important, and we have the power to overcome them with help, of course.
Yeah, not to fear the disease.
That's what it's for.
Yeah.
But the chronic diseases, that's a whole different thing. Then they're in there. They have a tendency to continue to be there. So we have to treat that in a different way than simply making war on them.
Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you for that. I'm going to invite Didi Hoover to come chat with you for a few minutes.
Okay.
And we may have to do this again to tackle chronic disease.
Okay.
So tell me a little bit about you. Just before we started talking right now, you had mentioned you have a wife. How long have you been married?
Let's see now. Just shy of 40 years.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. So do you have children?
Yes.
How many? Yes,
I have one son by a previous marriage.
Okay.
And with my present wife, I have a daughter, but it was my stepdaughter originally, okay. But I've adopted her. So she's—
Yay, that's nice.
And she's like 50.
Okay. We don't want to reveal your age.
But she has, so we have three grandchildren.
Okay. And that's what I was going to ask, is because I think that's the thing, is sometimes people forget that, just like Dr. Paul and how many kids, and he has grandchildren. I think we forget that you are still this wonderful man and this person who has a life outside of all of the work you do, especially with being an author and all the things you've done. So tell me about, you have a son and a daughter and you have grandkids. Tell me about, with your beliefs on vaccines, how have they been with that? Did they just follow in line with you, or was there ever any? No? Okay.
No, no, they think I'm wacko.
Okay.
they appreciate my style, my way of being with patients. They like that. But it's a little different with each one. But generally speaking, I would say that, number one, they don't particularly go for homeopathy. My wife is like, I've used it with her for various acute things, sometimes with success and sometimes not. But if she had like a chronic thing of some sort, she wouldn't go to a homeopath.
Oh, okay.
She likes the philosophy of it, but she doesn't go for the technique of it.
Okay. And that's your wife or your daughter?
That's my wife.
Okay.
And I would say my daughter feels this
same way.
And she's married to a scientist who works for NASA, and he loves to talk to me. We have great discussions, but he thinks I'm really out to lunch.
I know. I'm shaking my head because it's so, when you are in that world and all the people you've treated and all the results and all the things we're seeing, and there are still those people that sit outside of that cannot.
And it became even more emphatic during the COVID.
Yeah.
Because everybody was getting vaccinated and glad to get it.
I know. And so I'm guessing your grandchildren, are they CDC scheduled vaccinated?
I'm not sure exactly to what extent they follow the CDC routine. They may have abridged it slightly, like my daughter, for example. She and my wife got the original vaccine, the COVID and the booster, and one booster, and that was it. No more. They're done. So a certain amount of skepticism is there about the system.
How do you feel about that personally? Is that tough? That I'm guessing you did not get the vaccine.
No, I didn't. And no, it was a source of some argument with my wife, because she said it very eloquently, I think. She said, look, I'm not caring so much about what's going to happen 10 years from now. I want to have a life right now. I want to travel. And we love to travel. And we haven't been able to. And she's very worried about me getting the COVID. I had an autoimmune disease myself about 7 years ago that is sometimes fatal. And I did very well with it, but she's worried that it would come back. And indeed, that's been my very general experience with vaccines, that they make worse what's already there. So I was worried about it too. So I wore a mask and such. I was quite religious about it, even although not when I was outside. But if I went to the bank or the grocery store, I would wear the mask.
So, well, I think that's the thing is, and I'm sure you would agree, is whatever your choices are, they're your choices. my next question is, if you could do things differently with your life now, if you could go back, would you still pick the same route as a family doctor? Or knowing what you know about vaccines now, you have all this knowledge going back, would you be a pediatrician?
No, I think I liked it just the way it was. I had a long journey in medicine, and it was pretty tortuous at times. And there were, when I graduated from medical school, I left medicine completely. I got a fellowship in philosophy. I went to graduate school.
Okay, that's cool.
I didn't think I would ever see a patient again.
Okay.
But when I finally did and did the internship and went into practice, and then finally when I discovered homeopathy, and even before that, when I was doing home births, for example, I loved it. It was wonderful. I wouldn't change it. It showed me a way that I could be part of the medical profession and be proud of it.
No, and that's the thing is, obviously, you've done that and you had an amazing, successful practice. So I think that's part of it. I always ask that question, though, with knowing what we know about COVID and the different things. I always think that there's doctors like yourself who know and knew what a ton of stuff back then, that I always feel like prevention is the biggest thing. And I feel like pediatrics is the way to do that. And so many pediatricians are not on that page. So we definitely, the world could use more people like you in that space where we could start from the moment that baby is born and teach those parents how to do everything right.
But I'll tell you, I've always loved taking care of old people too. For a while, after I finished my internship, I was like taking care of the old folks home that was attached to the hospital. I was the doctor in charge of that. And I loved that. Now that I'm old myself, it just fits right in.
That's awesome. So are you completely retired or do you still work at all?
No, I'm completely retired.
Okay. So last question for you is, what would you say just personally in your life? Why do you think people still have the fear that they do over COVID and the diseases that they feel vaccines could actually help?
I think that in spite of everything, people still revere doctors and the technical achievements that it has achieved. And in a sense, right, there were plenty of times when the system that I've spent so much time criticizing bailed me out when I was in trouble.
Right.
But with vaccines, it's especially so. There's an almost religious reverence that's attached to that idea that has been cultivated, of course, by the drug industry, to be sure, but also by the medical profession. And it's sunk in. So people like Jonas Salk and Sabin and all of those folks are heroes in the popular imagination. And I can see why. I think that it's that the belief in vaccines is based on a misconception. I'm not fanatical about being anti-vaccine. I'm just saying that there's another side. There's a downside to them that we're not looking at. And it's true of all of them. It's true of the concept, not just this particular one or that particular one.
Right. And I think that's what's tough too, is just because of the way the world is and media and society and all that. The truth. I know the truth. We all know those things. But as long as people have fear, then I don't feel like they hear clearly. And so, yes, you're right. They're going to listen to doctors that think they should vaccinate or listen to the media or listen to those things.
And
so,
I don't want to say that I have the truth. I don't think I have the truth. I have part of the truth. They have part of the truth. You all have some truth. I remember a philosophy professor who happened to be a patient of mine when I was in Santa Fe, he said to me, sadly, said, "Everything is true." I love that because it really is true. No matter how far out belief is, there is a certain something to it. I'm not talking about someone who lies through their teeth. I'm not going to mention any names. But
well, yeah, that, That's the thing. And don't you think too, for you personally, with your wife and I don't know if it's one or both of your children, who they found, Dr. Paul and I talked about this all the time because he thinks there's one truth. And I'm always like, again, depending on what you feel, that you make that your truth. For right. them, their truth was they needed to do this to protect themselves.
Right.
So right. Do you, just in parting words, because we're running out of time, but parting words, what do you say to these new mamas out there that are just really fearful of, they want to do the best thing, obviously, for their child? Mm-hmm. And the world that Dr. Paul and I work in, we have a lot of people who do homeopathics. I was just at a birth with, they used homeopathics throughout the birth to help her. Yeah, it was incredible. I was blown away. I've never seen that before. It was great.
That was my first book was based on that.
Oh, cool. I'm going to have to read that one. What do you say to those new mamas who are trying to make the best decisions for themselves? Who do you tell them, besides Dr. Paul, who do you tell them to listen to? Who should they put their trust in?
I would encourage them to do their own research too, so that when they go to someone, they have a question, they have a question clearly in mind, and then they'll be able to judge whether this person is right for them or not, depending on how they answer it.
Right.
I think people have a pretty good sense of what's going to help them and what's not going to help them. And even though it may be, like you say, maybe based on a false belief, but it will guide them to do what they need to do at the time, even if it turns out to be mistaken. So I don't try to evangelize too much with patients, but if they ask me straight out, if they say, should I vaccinate? I would certainly say no. I would advise against it, and these are the reasons. But a lot of my patients continued to vaccinate to some extent. I didn't disown them if they didn't go along.
Well, thank God for that. And I think that's the biggest piece too, and we can end with, is thank you for that. I'm glad that you said that, because that's the toughest thing in pediatrics, is that if parents don't choose to vaccinate their children fully in some of these pediatric practices, they are kicked out. And that's why right. Dr. Paul had such a prominent practice in with unvaccinated families, or just honoring informed consent.
Yeah.
So that's thank you for that.
About. Sure. And
thank you for your time and letting me dive into who you are. And I wish you your best, and hopefully you can talk your grandchildren into not having your great grandchildren vaccinated.
I have a new book coming out, and I'm really serious.
What is it? Can you announce it?
Sure.
What is it?
It's called Sawbones.
What?
Sawbones was an old term that was used out west to describe just any old doctor. And it was a little bit derogatory even. It was like, oh, he's a Sawbones. All he does is amputate limbs and stuff. But I used it because it's really about basic doctoring in the most basic sense, which is very much what I was involved in.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time. And I look forward to meeting you in person someday.
Me too. It's nice to meet you, Deanie.
I look forward to running together with the wind at our backs, revealing the science that gives clarity in our world that's full of propaganda and misinformation. Visit our website, doctorsandscience.com. Sign up. Donate if you can. Your support makes a difference. And let's make this the weekly show the world has been waiting for. Thanks for watching. I'm Dr. Paul.